From the National Catholic Register, this is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
The death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has left a seat on the U.S. Supreme Court vacant, and President Donald Trump has pledged to fill it immediately. What are the implications of this new confirmation process, and what does it mean for Catholics and the pro-life cause? Register Senior Editor Joan Frawley Desmond brings us her coverage of the Supreme Court vacancy. And then President Trump this week announced that he would be signing the Born Alive executive order to ensure that all babies born after a botched abortion receive the medical care they need. We are joined by EWTN News' political affairs correspondent Kate Scanlon to discuss the details. I'm Jeanette DeMello, editor-in-chief of the National Catholic Register, and I'm joined by my co-host Matthew Bunsen. Hi, Matthew.
Hello. Big week in Washington, D.C. again.
Exactly. What a surprising week. I mean, with the justice, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, passing last week, and this has been really quite unexpected, even though she has been struggling for some time now with her health.
She has, and what this has done is to scramble what had been an already contentious election cycle, presidential mm-hmm. election. Now we have a brutal battle ahead of us potentially for the confirmation and all the implications for the pro-life cause, potential anti-Catholicism in the judiciary hearings. So this is going to be a wild ride for all of us, I think.
It most certainly is. And really, we didn't expect this now. So let's bring Joan on. She's been covering the Supreme Court for the Register for quite some time now and has been covering this very closely in the past week. Hi, Joan. Welcome back to Register Radio.
Hi, Jeanette and Matthew.
So this new vacancy, as Matthew said, has really set off what is going to be a very contentious fight. This week, the nation is mourning. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has been laying outside the court this week, and I don't know how if there's been a public viewing, really, because of the COVID restrictions, but this is a week of mourning, but it's also been a week where the media has just gone crazy, basically speculating what is going to happen in the confirmation battle. What are the issues? What's at play?
Honestly, Jeanette, when I saw the news, I just practically fell.
I know, me too.
I don't know about the rest of you, because I think all of us who covered these issues were just like in a state of shock, as if things weren't difficult enough. And, you know, so yesterday, Chief Justice Roberts eulogized Ginsburg as a trailblazing lawyer, advocate for women's equality. And he apparently was red-eyed. I think, you know, he may be a Republican and she may be a Democrat appointee, but it goes to show that there is a lot of support for Ginsburg as an icon, maybe a liberal icon, but also an icon as for women who have been working in public service and in one of the highest positions in the land. And a lot of depth of support for that, huge numbers of people wanting to go and visit her body, and very poignant images of the justices, the remaining justices, all somberly there present for her farewell. And so very touching on that point. Apparently several of the justices, or I guess they haven't met basically physically, and so that was a big change for them from this sheltering in place regime. I'm not sure what that involves. But getting on to the issues, I think Matthew said it pretty well in the opening remarks. We have on the one side a president wanting to continue to fulfill his pledge to pro-life voters in particular, that he will nominate justices who apply the law and ultimately will take aim, ideally anyway, at Roe v. Wade at some point in the future. So he now has a chance to do that again. And Amy Comey Barrett is at the top of the list. At the same time, we have Democrats who are fuming over Senator McConnell blocking the nomination of Merrick Garland at the end of President Obama's term. They felt that was unfair and it should have gone forward. And now they see something similar in their minds happening again. And so they have said that everything is on the table, according to Senator Schumer. And so I think people are steeling themselves. And the fear is that this could lead to what has already been partly a downward spiral in terms of collegiality from the early days pre-Judge Bork to a relatively congenial Senate hearing process with bipartisan support to a situation now where at least Republican nominees are in most but not every case given a very tough ride as they face the Senate judiciary. And so people expect to have the same thing happen again now, with the possibility that if the Democrats take power, they have threatened to so-called pack the courts, which they technically could do, meaning that several seats could be added to the court, which is now a 9-seat court.
Let's talk, at least for now, we know that President Trump has promised to announce a nominee Saturday, and we're recording this before Saturday, although our listeners will be hearing it as this announcement is probably taking place. So let's talk about who the front runners have been. One is Amy Coney Barrett, who was reported as a front runner when Brett Kavanaugh was chosen, and now she's emerged as the front runner now. There's a second possibility, Judge Barbara Lagoa, who's a Cuban American from Florida. So, you know, we've been looking at her this week. Both women are Catholics. What do we know about them, Joan?
Amy Coney Barrett is by far the sort of best known of the two. She was a front, you know, was kind of the next in line after Brett Kavanaugh. She almost got that nomination. It said that Trump said he was saving her for Ginsburg's seat. He, of course, had no idea when that might come. She is a beloved Notre Dame law school professor, mother of seven, a noted scholar, widely published in journals, law journals across the country. So respected on her scholarship, a respected professor at Notre Dame. Her students have all endorsed her nominations, irrespective of their own political positions. And so I think we have somebody that the pro-life movement trusts, that conservatives who take their guidance from the Federalist Society, the Federalist Society being a conservative organization that both encourages and helps organize events for lawyers who believe that the law should be interpreted according to how the framers intended it to be, that we shouldn't have activist judges on the bench. And, of course, this applies to Roe v. Wade, with many conservative scholars arguing that legislation was effectively taking place when they found the right to privacy, the undergirding the foundation of Roe v. Wade. So that's where Amy Coney Barrett is coming from. She's respected and trusted as an originalist scholar and as a pro-life Catholic who is likely to support at some future point the possibility of overturning Roe v. Wade. On the other side, we have Barbara Lagoa. She's not well known in generally, and it was very striking to me when I spoke with experts I've been in touch with for many of these Supreme Court battles. They really, some were quite circumspect. Others said they were ready to support her, but there was a lot of hesitation. People don't want to get burned again. You know, there have been questions about recent Supreme Court nominees and what happened after they were confirmed. So people aren't ready, I sense, at the same level, but she is a Cuban-American woman, highly respected, and very much a trailblazer in Florida as the first Hispanic woman to be the chief of the Florida Supreme Court. She moved up very quickly and has the full backing of the GOP leadership. And, of course, that's key in election year. This could help bring Florida, which is we know is always tricky, into the Republican fold for the presidential election. And apparently that was a factor.
Absolutely. I mean, the political stakes are very high. I mean, this is not only we're not only looking at what their background is, and we're really also looking at who can actually get through this process. you know, as you mentioned and as Matthew mentioned, this is already a contentious time. There are already very deep divisions in Congress. So this is not something that is likely to no one is likely to get through this process very quickly. So what is the timeline, Joan? What happens next? I mean, President Trump is announcing his candidate.
It's very tight, I think. And a lot of people wonder if it can happen. But from what I'm reading, and of course, this is a work in progress, Trump is expected to nominate his choice by Saturday. So by tomorrow, by Saturday, if not Friday. And what we know so far is that he has met with Judge Barrett and apparently has not met with Judge Lagoa as of yet, unless that happens secretly, and sometimes that does happen. So people are taking much from that and expect that Judge Barrett will be the nominee. It's always possible something could change. And so we'll hear about that by Saturday. And that means that Senator McConnell is going to have to organize the hearings by the Judiciary Committee to start very, very rapidly. And remember that Barrett has already had kind of a preview of this in her Seventh Circuit confirmation hearings. And so they already have a lot of information about her. I suspect that the talking points are being organized on all sides already. And so I had read in, I think, the Washington Post that they could push for a vote before the end of October, which would be very rapid.
Right. And I just want to add, I mean, you mentioned how experts feel, or, you know, how they hypothesize about each of these candidates. The reason why so many people are comfortable with Amy Coney Barrett is because she's been through this process before, and many people know where she stands quite clearly on abortion. And the issue with Barbara Lagoa is that is not as apparent. She hasn't had to rule on abortion cases, so it's a less clear where she would stand on that particular issue. I think that is that's an important part of this process is just recognizing their histories. Now we know, Joan, that Amy Coney Barrett ran into what many view as anti-Catholic bias in the process. Let's recount that, and are we expecting that to come up again?
There are two issues, Jeanette, two prongs of attack, I would say. But the primary theme is that she's an ultra Catholic jurist, and people say they fear that her faith will drive her rulings and not, you know, a proper application of the constitutional principles at work. And so that's the argument. They've selectively looked at some law review articles dating back to her law school days, where they tried to suggest that she might recuse herself because she's discussed how Catholic judges might deal with such issues as capital punishment. But then other scholars have pointed out she's already been the judge now, and she has ruled and has participated on decisions involving issues that may be in conflict with Catholic teaching. So the point being, would a Catholic judge be able in conscience to rule on a, you know, a death penalty case if the church has weighed in saying the death penalty effectively should almost never be used? And she says it's possible to do, and she has, even as a law clerk under Justice Scalia, advised him on a death penalty case. So it doesn't seem to be an actual issue, but this has been raised and will continue to be raised. People have used her remarks. She gave a speech to Notre Dame law students at a commencement address where she said they should always think about the larger good and even the kingdom of God as they pursue their careers. So people have tried to say she's trying to advance some theocratic agenda. And I spoke with my story on with Carter Sneed, a fellow law professor at Notre Dame. And he made the point that Notre Dame's whole mission is to inculcate a sense that the law is a vocation, a Christian vocation, in the sense that you do your best, that you're advancing the common good, not that you're trying to promote religious, you know, articles of faith, but rather that respect for the common good to serve to serve the law as opposed to use the law to impose your will on others. So it's presented by her allies in a very positive sense, but people are using it in a negative sense. And finally, the New York Times had an article that came out just as the Senate was about to vote on Barrett's last nomination for the Seventh Circuit. And this article was about a Christian charismatic community she's involved with, and they tried to suggest that she was under some kind of pressure by this group to vote in a certain way, that she would be influenced by them, and that she wouldn't be fully free as a judge to make her own deliberations. That issue has returned again because Margaret Atwood's dystopian novel, Handmaid's Tale, has been used recently. It actually was brought up even in the Kavanaugh trial, the idea being that religious jurists will promote an aggressive and punitive theocratic regime on the country, and that will put women, you know, back in some, you know, in some secondary role and not give them the full equality that they have today. Of course, there's no basis for this, but it's been argued before, and Newsweek, as I point out in my article, just published something this week trying to make a connection between Atwood's novel, which has gotten a lot of play because it's been turned into a television production, and Amy Comey Barrett's charismatic community. Then at the end of the article, Jeanette, they point out that actually there is no connection, and they had to issue a clarification saying so. But nevertheless, this allegation continues to float around the internet.
Right.
And if you do a Google search, you'll have no trouble finding it.
Right. It's hard to break up those kind of myths. But our reporting is seeking precisely to do that, to shed light on the truth of these two candidates, and we'll continue to cover them. Joan's article that we've been talking about can be found at ncregister.com. It's called Catholics Amy Coney Barrett and Barbara Lagoa Are Leading Candidates for Supreme Court Nomination. We also have an article about that community that Amy Coney Barrett is a part of. It's called People of Praise. So who are the People of Praise? I invite you to go to ncregister.com to take a look at that. We're going to take a break right now, and when we come back, Matthew and I will talk to EWTN News political affairs correspondent Kate Scanlon. This is Register Radio on EWTN.
In these uncertain times, Catholics depend on EWTN's National Catholic Register. The Register is so much more than a newspaper. It's your faith, your life, your source of information and spiritual resources. The Register is uplifting, redemptive journalism, interviews with Catholic leaders and newsmakers, liturgical coverage, health, financial, and political topics, and analysis of the key issues you care most about. EWTN's National Catholic Register covers every aspect of the Catholic faith that impacts your world. To get 6 free issues, order online at ncregister.com/radio or call 800-421-3230 and mention code radio. That's ncregister.com/radio or call 800-421-3230 and mention code radio. The National Catholic Register. Read faithfully.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
Welcome back. I'm Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the National Catholic Register, and I'm joined by my co-host, Matthew Bunsen, here on Register Radio. And Matthew, it's been a very Washington, D.C.-centric show this week. And
feels like it's been a D.C.-centric year.
You're absolutely right, in fact. And that's just the nature of, I guess, an election year. But there's been, you know, some challenging news that we talked about in the last segment about the vacancy on the Supreme Court and how contentious that's going to be. But there's now some really positive news, and that happened this week with President Trump announcing that he would be signing a very interesting executive order. Pro-lifers are all ears to see what he has in mind here. So let's let you lead this, since you're in D.C. and have a closer up view of this than I do.
Well, yeah, it's at the National Catholic Prayer Breakfast just this last week, where Trump said that he is going to sign an executive order on Born Alive, echoing arguments, as our next guest is going to tell us, in favor of the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, a bill notably that has yet to be passed. And so Kate Scanlon joining us. Thank you so much for coming in here, because I know you've been doing some immediate reporting on this.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me. Yeah, this is a really interesting development from the president. It's not immediately clear what this executive order is going to be, but it's likely that it will mirror the Born Alive Act, as you said. He's indicated his support for it. He recently mentioned it in a letter to pro-life leaders as a priority for his second term. So it's anticipated that it will be similar.
So for some background, there have been a number of versions of this bill. I want to ask you about the one from 2002, for example. But most recently, the struggle to get this thing passed.
So the one from 2002 guarantees legal personhood to a child that's born following a botched abortion. However, the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act would guarantee medical care.
So let's stop for a second. That one from 2002 did pass, right? It is law.
Yes, yes.
And by a pretty wide margin.
Exactly, yes. And so that's a lot of times why you'll hear opponents of this bill say infanticide is already illegal because of that bill. However, as we've seen, as we've heard from people like Jill Stanek, there are these really unfortunate cases. Governor Northam highlighted some of these unfortunate cases last summer where this procedure is not followed through, where you might be a legal person under the law, but in the immediate aftermath, these children are abandoned and they're not given the appropriate medical care. And so this bill seeks to address that.
And so this, you said, I cut you off, but you said the 2019 bill seeks to address that, and that's the bill that has never made it really to
exactly avert. Yes, it's been blocked in both the House and Senate by various means. There was a discharge petition in the House to try, which is a mechanism the minority can use to try and bring a bill to the floor for a vote. That is about 13 signatures short of success right now, and in the Senate it's failed to overcome a filibuster, although it's been introduced there at least 3 times.
Yeah, so what is the difference, for example, between 2002 and 2019 that a bill could pass so readily then, and now it's such a different struggle?
Well, I think one thing you've seen is the complete absence of pro-life Democrats now. As Dan Lipinski in the House can demonstrate, in the past, you had people who were willing to say, you know, I'm pro-choice, but I am going to protect infants. In some of these more extreme cases, you might not be able to get somebody on a first trimester, but you might be able to get them in the third, and this is even beyond that. So that kind of culture of these kind of compromises is completely gone.
So we have a prospective executive order to be signed, apparently. Indications of some of the language? I know that it's a little hazy yet.
It's a little hazy. The activists I've spoke to were optimistic about it. I know Jeannie Mancini told our own EWTN News Nightly this week that she's thrilled about this. So it'll be interesting to see the exact text of the executive order, if it will even hold up. That remains to be seen, too, because it's still hazy. But I was able to get reaction from Senator Ben Sasse, who authored the Born Alive bill in the Senate. And he basically told me, you know, this is really simple. Every baby deserves medical care, and that's all we're trying to do. This isn't even a bill about abortion. This is a bill about a child who's already been born. So he's hoping that Congress will follow the president's lead and pass his legislation.
So what would be a potential argument that a child born should not be receiving this?
You got me. I mean, it's the most common argument you hear against this is that infanticide is already illegal. They see this as redundant or et cetera. But as we know, it's not, because these cases happen.
Right. I mean, basically, yeah. You've heard people say that this is the president trying to solve a problem that isn't a problem.
Exactly.
And that's not true if it means, right. You know, I mean, for those children who have survived, I mean, because we have people who we can speak to who have survived abortions, like those are examples right there that this does happen. And I don't know if it was you, Kate, or if it was Loretta Brown, who actually has spoken to OBs who have covered these kinds of situations and can attest to what has happened, to nurses who have been there and have comforted without being able to provide the care that is needed to babies that are dying. So this does happen. We've actually spoken to people who have been in the room.
We have. And one memorable interview that I've done in my career was with Melissa Odin, who's one of these babies who survived a botched abortion. And it's right there in her medical records. So there's documentation for this. So it absolutely does happen. It's very rare, but it does happen.
You know, what's really amazing to me is the act that we've been talking about, the Born Alive Survivors Protection Act. It has 205 signatures. It needs 218 to basically force a vote. I mean, they're so close. They're so close. But really, at this point in time, they can't get there. And they needed the president to have an executive order. Well, as you mentioned, we don't even know if that's going to be effective because he's only got a few more months in his term, right? And then it's going to be challenged, too, if he does survive to a second term. So this is not going to cut it, even though it's a great move. It's not going to cut it in terms of protecting these babies.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely a very real concern in all of this. And I do think it's remarkable, as you mentioned, there's only 13 signatures needed in the House for this. It's remarkable how few changes of heart would need to happen to bring this mm-hmm. about. And so I think that's an interesting takeaway for us from this is we need to be praying for 13 people to have a change of heart.
Is this the type of legal battle that could end up at the high court, which, of course, brings us back to sort of the discussion of the day?
Absolutely. It very well could end up there.
Right. I mean, because I think about President Obama's executive order on immigration that really got turned around in the courts. So this is precisely where court appointees do matter. And so this week, as usual lately, has been fascinating. And you know, we're all on the edge of our seats to see what happens. I'm grateful to both of you there in Washington. Covering this really up close. I'm doing it from my seat in Louisiana, and it's completely different. It's a different environment. But Matthew, Kate, you guys are doing great work.
Thank you so much.
Remember, for more news, analysis, and commentary, check out the National Catholic Register online at ncregister.com. There you can find Kate's story. It's basically an explainer about the Born Alive Act and the president's executive order. Thanks for joining us here on Register Radio on EWTN. For Matthew Bunsen and our producer, Jeff Burson, I'm Jeanette DeMello. Until next week, God bless you.